May it please the court, Mr. DeBroda. The district court in the Ellis matter, in the overruling of the motion to exclude personal expenditures of Ms. Ellis in violation of Federal Rule 403, committed the reversible error that we believe deals in the limine issue. As the court knows, that the time of the motion in limine both preceded the trial of this matter and was renewed during the course of the trial by trial counsel. The court in its original ruling, indicating that the denial of the motion in limine on that issue, said that the court would expect the government to go through those issues, but that they didn't expect the court to do it and the government to do it in loving detail intended to inflame the jury.
You know, the government has argued that even if it was error to admit some of the evidence to which Ms. Ellis objects, the error was harmless due to the weight of the other evidence. Would you like to respond to the harmless error argument?
I would, Your Honor. Yes, the government indicated, and I think they set out a category of maybe 15 arguments, conceding that maybe four or five of the original arguments under that portion of their brief, in the event that they were in fact harmful to Ms. Ellis and her presentation at the trial, were offset by the other 11 areas in the record. The problem with that, Your Honor, is we don't have the ability to look at a juror's decision other than to what it rendered, guilty or not guilty. When you say the evidence may have in fact prejudiced the jury, you are looking at things that the district court, in making its initial ruling, indicated to the parties that there wouldn't be this loving detail, as the court used that term, about the kinds of things that the government offered into evidence. It should have been sufficient enough for the government to have said, Miss Ellis used funds to build her home. But what the government did is they bring in the witness, Mrs. Pate, the wife of the builder. They bring in Mr. Hacker from Triphase Electronics, and they go through every particular, the room of the house, the square footage of the house, the swimming pool, the amount of money spent on the stereo system. And so by the time you get to the end of the government's case, you're not able to put the elephant out of the room, because the jurors are thinking at that point that we have taken loving detail, exactly what the court indicated it would monitor, because the court recognized in its original ruling in denying the motion in limine that it didn't want the government to inflame the jury.
But one of the things the government was doing was showing the rough equivalence of the amount of money that she failed to turn over that she should have in these employment taxes and the personal expenditures, not down to the dime, but roughly about the same.
That's correct.
So surely that is, you know, if it's a $1.5 million house and a $66,000 swimming pool and all the rest of it, why isn't that?
But, Judge, that's exactly the point.
The government's entitled, we know even from Old Chief, the government's entitled to prove its case more or less the way it wants to.
Well, the government can do that in proving its case, but the court gave some guideline and indication to the government in the rulings on the motion.
But the court didn't say you've gone overboard.
Well, that's why we're here.
That's what I'm saying. The court gave the guideline. The court seemed to think the government stayed within the boundaries that the court had established.
The point that the appellate issue is for this court is on both of those motion in limine, that the inflaming, which the court indicates it was trying to avoid, clearly crept through this case. It began when they began putting on evidence relating to the house. And in your question about does the amount of money become important, well, it became important, but the government didn't put it in that way. The government put it in this detail where you began to think that this woman has altered her process because it wasn't an inability to pay. And I think that's what happened. The court initially believed that it might have been a defense of inability, but trial counsel made a decision tactically that it was an area of forgetfulness, that that's how that case really was proffered to the jury. But you had measure those two things when you have a situation where all of these indications are to the jury that we are going to spend time and we're going to listen to everybody who was inside that house and working on that house. If you were just to confine the government to how much was the house worth without going through every possible detail, then I believe that you might be able to argue to this court that maybe that becomes harmless. But it can't outweigh those factors that the harm began to creep in immediately through the testimony of those supporting witnesses.
Well, the witnesses that you know that are being complained about were people with whom she met with on multiple occasions for extensive meetings to discuss the house and the upgrades. And the amount of time she spent doing this and the kind of level of detail and thought were relevant, you know, that she put into it were relevant to her defense, that she was so busy and scattered that she forgot to pay. Rather, what the government was able to show with this was that she was a very organized woman who was on top of all of the details of her home project. And all of that, it seems to me, certainly would be relevant to the issue of willfulness and intent, which the government had to prove.
I think that Your Honor's question about the relevancy as it relates to the people who she was meeting with, fine, let's confine it to that. Did you meet with Mr. Pate? Yes. How long? 20 minutes. Did you meet with Mr. Hacker? 20 minutes, 30 minutes. But then they began going into the subpart of the testimony of not only was the length of the meeting important, because then that would really offset the argument that the defense would have made at the trial that she was forgetful because she's spending time doing other things. But you have to balance it with the seven states that she's working in, that the business grew from 25 pharmacists to over 1,000 that she's managing. But you let the government, during the course of the trial, begin going in and using those time frames in which you're saying this is taking her away from her taxable purpose of paying her 941s, but you don't have to go deeper. You don't have to begin specifying how much did she spend. Why is it relevant that she spent $62,000 on a swimming pool? Why?
It's relevant because when you add it all up, it comes to $2 million. And that's, as Judge Wood noted, basically the amount that she should have been, you know, paying into the IRS.
But I think you could. But what I think it does, it shows a difference between just saying a figure on the board with your expert that we find that there's $2 million worth of expenditures that she had given to others during the course of a period of time when her tax returns should have reflected that she was paying this withholding.
Well, when she should have, in fact, been paying the withholding, not just the tax returns. But the problem I'm having with your argument is it's really striking me as micromanaging the district judge. You're facing, as you well know, an abuse of discretion standard of review. And I wouldn't have been surprised at all to hear you, and these arguments were made to the district judge, but the district judge found enough in this balance, and I am not sure that it's this court's role to say that the district judge struck the wrong balance. Well, we don't want to sit around micromanaging every trial.
Well, I'm not saying that you should do that. I agree with the court, but here's what you have. Where you have the court setting out a standard at the beginning of a ruling in the fall before the trial begins in February and says to the parties, I'm going to deny your motion because I don't want this government to go into loving detail. Those were his words in the order.
Oh, no.
And he didn't want this jury to be prejudiced by those kinds of details because the government in its reply brief kind of indicated what was going to happen. We're going to do this, and here's how we're going to do it, and here's why we're calling these witnesses. But yet, it is abuse of discretion when in the trial as it proceeds, the thing that the court has told you is not going to do, it begins to happen. And it happens repetitively through the testimony of both Ms. Pate and Mr. Hacker. And so you are in that position that you are abusing the discretion, really, that you have let the parties know initially that you're going to set a ground rule. And so suddenly the rule changes in the middle of the game. It is an abuse of discretion.
But the other thing about the middle of the game, and I don't want to cut into your rebuttal time too much, is just that the defense in the meantime was keeping open various theories of defense. And now it's kind of settled down into this forgetfulness theory. But there were a lot of different possibilities, and the government had to be prepared for all of them.
Well, and I think the government was prepared. But both parties in having pretrial motions have a sense of what the rules are to the game before the game is played. And when the court specifically indicates to the parties that he does not want to have this type of detail in the record for exactly that reason. It's the court's rationale that this very thing could prejudice the jury to the point that they may be inflamed by the fact that they don't have a house that's worth $2 million or they don't have a $62,000 swimming pool, and it's not really relevant to the issue of whether or not she's paying her taxes.
Okay.
I'll reserve the rest. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Mr. Wilds. Mr. DeBrada?
May it please the Court, Mr. Voiles. My name is Steve DeBrode. I was one of the trial counsel for the United States. Addressing first the issue of whether there was error on the personal expenditures, it's important to start with what the judge said pretrial, which was that he would allow the testimony with some limits, but then also look what happened as the trial developed. In the opening statement, the defense attorney, not Mr. Voiles, said that Ms. Ellis' business took every moment of her time, essentially all of her time. That means the government is entitled to show that that's not true. That's how the trial started. That was different than what they had telegraphed in their pretrial pleadings the defense might be. On her direct examination and in her cross-examination, she said that she knew of her employment tax obligations but didn't know that the taxes were not being paid and the obligations were not being fulfilled. There's two parts of this obligation. There's filing basically forms, quarterly forms, and then there's paying over the funds. She claimed to be overwhelmed with other things and denied knowing that these taxes weren't paid and that the reports were not filed. The taxes were not paid, she says, because she didn't have enough time. If you look at the arguments that the government made in this case, principally, they were directed to showing she had plenty of time in which to do this, fulfill this obligation. The amount of funds she spends in the way she spends them, the type of funds, the source of funds, the pattern of spending them, the time period of spending them, and the multiple meetings it took to spend them are all relevant to showing both that she knows she's spending funds that really are supposed to go to the IRS, which is part of it, but also that she's spending a lot of time that she could have spent fulfilling this obligation to pay over and report to the IRS. Now, in the testimony at trial, it showed she had a Peachtree accounting system. She knew it could produce these numbers. She actually produced W-2s year-end for her employees that state these numbers. And it would have taken only a few minutes for her to actually file the 941 forms and pay over the money to the IRS. That's the testimony, just a few minutes.
Do people normally file these things electronically? Is that why it's or just
people? Some businesses do, and this business in the period in question netted $9 million in gross receipts, and as Mr. Voiles pointed out, at times had as many as 1,000 employees. In those circumstances, many businesses do what Ms. Ellis did for the period of time prior to the charges, which is hire an outside vendor like ADP. But when her business relationship with ADP breaks down in January of 2001, she takes on this burden internally to her business and has an accounting system and an outside expert that sets it up. In early 2001, she actually makes some of these payments on checks that say in the memo line that they are for 941 estimated taxes. Okay, so that's the starting period of this. She knew about the obligation. She admitted that on cross-examination. The only thing left to her was, I forgot, and I was overwhelmed. When you spend the money, in effect, on personal expenditures instead of sending it to the government, it's relevant that they're what those expenditures are about. And the amount of detail that we put in here was not offensive to the district court. It included testimony about her deciding how to put in a very expensive system that involved multiple home entertainment features at her house that totaled $250,000 that required
now,
a bunch
now,
of meetings.
Mr. DeBroda, I have to say the jury was almost certainly inflamed at the notion that she was only spending $140,000 on a house for her mother, whereas her house was in the $2 million range.
Well, that does give you a differential of her priorities, for sure. She also
I
bought
hope
an
there
Infiniti.
Were no mothers on the jury.
She was Miss Ellis is an educated, successful, controlling individual, the evidence showed. She's good at multitasking. She was very knowledgeable and ran a very, very successful business. Unfortunately, she also cheated on her taxes for a decade, including the 8 quarters that are involved in this case.
What specific statements at trial support the district court's finding that she obstructed justice in testifying during her trial?
I think we cited in our brief the specific phraseology the district court used at the sentencing hearing.
Yeah, but
okay. And also, when in the sentencing transcript, the judge says, in effect, I don't have to repeat the numerous statements that were in my closing argument. What I did in my closing argument is I essentially went down the pattern of why we think this case is harmless error, those roughly 15 reasons she didn't forget. He makes reference to those and then goes on to say in page 25 through 27 of the transcript, I'm not going to recap Mr. DeBroda's closing argument either, although I've reviewed my notes on it, and all of the reasons why the defendant could not have possibly forgotten to pay over $2 million in withholding taxes over a 2-year period, over 100 payrolls, when she was creating W-2 forms and reporting to the government that she had withheld those forms from employees, receiving her own paycheck every week, indicating the taxes had been withheld from her paycheck. Essentially, what he's doing is he's citing the numerous reasons I said in greater detail. He then says, it's inconceivable she could not have noticed that she did have an extra $2 million to spend over those 2 years given that history. This case was on the failures to pay, and the defendant's responsibility for those failures to pay and to file was overwhelming. Obviously, the government still had to prove willfulness beyond a reasonable doubt, and on the stand, she denied it willfully. He then went into, in that 25 to 27 area of the thing, a recounting of the essential point that she testified she forgot when there was overwhelming evidence she didn't forget this obligation.
Okay, so that was the obstruction.
Yeah, that I didn't have enough too much. That she didn't have enough too little time, and that she didn't do this on purpose. She essentially tried to claim that she noticed she'd not fulfilled this obligation in a meeting with an IRS agent at the end of the period of time. Suddenly, it occurred to her that she had built a house, bought an Infiniti, built her mom a house, and spent $500,000 in personal expenditures rather than paying over the money to the IRS and file the forms. That was essentially her claim. Now, part of that, too, goes to the second issue. She didn't file her business income tax returns for 10 years, preceding and including this period, and her personal returns, despite having employed an accounting firm between 1995 and 99, ADP, a payroll check firm from 99 to 2001, and having an accounting system in her business that produced year-end reports that went into evidence that showed tax liabilities and so forth, including providing W-2s to all of her 1,000 employees, every one of which was falsely stating money had been paid to the IRS and wasn't. At the end of the day, the fact that she maintained and produced checks internal to her business really shows that her statement she forgot is just nonsensical. But that's what she had to work with. Our position is the case law supporting long periods of non-payment and non-filing of taxes are well recognized in this district. This is very similar, although more egregious, frankly, than the situation in the Zizzo case and some of the other ones that we cited. As to the question of the level of specificity of our proof of personal expenditures, this appeal does not appear to be about the denial of a specific objection to a ruling on the specificity of those records.
Can you remind me how many such specific objections as you were going through this proof were made, or was the defense just relying on the motion in limine?
When I was listening to the argument earlier, I was trying to remember if there were, in fact, any objections on the scope of the motion in limine. I'm not sure there were. What I remember from my memory is there would have been hardly any.
So under looking at Rule 103, then, of the evidence rules, was it it's often the case that a judge will make a ruling on a motion in limine, but then leave open the possibility of either fine-tuning it or modifying it as the trial unfolds. And I'm wondering whether that was it, whether it's the government's position, at least, that that was the way this was going on. They should have said, we object to the swimming pool evidence, or whatever they wanted to say.
Exactly. And if you looked at the number of documents we put into evidence and what was said at the time, I don't think you're going to find multiple objections on that point of specificity, apart from a generalized objection at some point. I imagine they did preserve it. I'm not arguing they didn't do that. What they didn't do is it's not a jot-for-jot ruling on evidence like that. Now, as to the developing nature of trials, the judge said on page 835 of the record, quote, the evidence, because of the issue of willfulness, and particularly in light of the defendant's overall defense theory and her testimony today, makes that relevant. Evidence very appropriate under Rule 404B, as well as the extent to which it needs to be treated under that rule. So the judge basically in this case says at several points, what I said prior to trial, I'm even more convinced now this evidence comes in. And he specifically says at a page we cite in our brief, when you make a defense that I don't have enough time to get to this obligation, you essentially make relevant every other thing you're doing. And when the government can show that you can fulfill your tax obligations in a very short period of time with internal to her business ability to wire funds, we should have been entitled to show anything else she was doing to belie that assertion. Now, we didn't show that she went on extensive gambling streaks. We didn't show that she bought cocaine or anything like that. What we showed was that she acted and spent money like a very successful person. And if anything, given that they tried a story of a person growing from modest means to extremely successful with a business idea and working very hard, the idea that we were showing she had an expensive house isn't necessarily even prejudicial at all. It might make some members of the jury respect her all the more. They also had witnesses that talked about how she contributed money to churches, for example, which is an expenditure that takes time as well. When you put all that together, we don't think it's the type of evidence that has any really particularly prejudicial effect in any event, simply showing that she's educated, successful, and so forth. But at the end of the day, what the judge said is how she spends the money is relevant to her knowledge that it had been spent on something other than taxes. If she'd spent the money by sending it to the state of Ohio, for example, on some other type of tax, or to Canada, then there could be a possible area of confusion on thinking it had gone to the federal government.
She was current with her Indiana taxes, though, I thought you said.
Yeah. In fact, an irony is she paid her state employment taxes, just not the federal ones, probably because they were working in so many different states. If she had cheated on that as well, it would increase her chance of being caught. But that was great evidence on our part of knowledge of the obligation to pay employment taxes that she claimed she forgot. Now, in her trial testimony, she candidly admits knowing there was an obligation. That was handy. But she denied remembering that she hadn't fulfilled it all those 8 quarters. But the point is, when she spends the money on an infinity, on personal items, on a house for her mother, or on a $2.5 million house, that was the final price tag, she can't very well claim she thought that was money going to the IRS, which would have gone an entirely different route and a different amount to a different source. So the detail was also relevant in that sense. I won't recount the categories of evidence. There were 15 that we said went beyond the challenged categories that cited in our brief. Unless the court has any questions on the sentencing aspect of the case, including the fine, I'd yield the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Broda. Mr. Pilots.
Please, the court. As to the question by Judge Wood indicating that the motions were renewed, trial transcript, volume 3, page 544 and 546, and the issue on the tax liability where those periods of time is volume 3, page 547 and 552. I think that's just prior to the arguments, Your Honor, where they were done by trial counsel.
Thank you.
When you look at the standard review, Judge Rovner indicated that it is our belief also that the district court needed to really spell out in the sentencing phase and not necessarily just rely on the argument of counsel when the court imposed the two-level enhancement in order for the allegation that Ms. Ellis had in fact perjured herself while testimony. As we all know, that's a kind of a chilling effect on a defendant. If you say to the defendant, if you take the stand and I think you're lying, I'm going to add 2 points if you're convicted to your sentence because it is my belief that such testimony was false. What you have to do really is to indicate in the final record so the Court of Appeals, if there is in fact a conviction, can assess whether or not merely stating that your belief or your feeling about your conduct was in fact what happened in this case, so it doesn't become a categorical, I'm just deciding whether or not to believe you, and if I don't believe you, then I'm going to say that you perjured yourself. Because it has a severe ramification on any defendant who would choose to testify in their own defense. And in this particular case, Judge Hamilton, we don't believe, totally articulated, that he is feeling that the perjury had committed because Ms. Ellis testified, and according to the government in their reply here today, indicated that they believe that she was truthful about so many things in terms of the fact that she, in fact, knew about filing certain returns and how she knew, but they've picked out, if you believe part of it, but yes, we feel categorically that she's perjured herself so we can enhance the sentencing level 2 levels. And you also have an effect because then that affects the issue of the fine. The court chose to impose the $1,800,000 fine. If you would say that the sentencing level was enhanced inappropriately and it should have been the level 22, not only does it affect the amount of imprisonment that would be imposed by the court, but it would also possibly affect, because under the 22 category of the sentencing calculation, the maximum amount to suggest for a fine is $7,500 or $75,000, respectively, under U.S. Sentencing Guide 5E12C3. So it has great ramifications.
But it does seem to me the district judge stopped and talked specifically about each of the elements for the obstruction enhancement. Was her testimony false? Was it material? Was it willful? And, you know, yes, she takes the stand, but you're not allowed to take the stand and lie. And it seems to me the district court finds that her statements, I was forgetful, were just out and out untruthful. And material and willful. So our standard of review at this point is for clear error.
And I think that there was in this particular case, because you weigh it upon what the government has said was the credibility of Mrs. Ellis in terms of acknowledging certain facts.
Saying she did lie about the core fact, the central issue in the case.
Well, I think that becomes the issue for the jury, because her defense was forgetfulness. But yet she acknowledged on the stand that she, in fact, had some knowledge that certain returns were to be filed. So that becomes then a jury question. But if you say to...
Well, and then the district court, though, has to make these findings for the obstruction
correct.
Enhancement.
And when the district court imposes itself on the point of saying, I believe because you said it was forgetfulness, I don't think you forgot, I'm going to punish you 2 levels.
Well, and he relies on all of this evidence in the record for that. It's not just a simple credibility determination. But when a district judge thinks that somebody has deliberately lied under oath, that's one of the things obstruction covers.
Sure, but see, what happens then is you put the district court in a very difficult position, because is he going to then say to the jury, I believe she was telling the truth about everything else?
Well, this is afterwards. The conviction's already in. We're in the sentencing stage. The jury has spoken.
I understand the jury has spoken, but then that's why I think that the sentencing guidelines require much more articulate on behalf of the district court judge in order to make those enhancements permanent.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.